Welcome, listeners, to Connect the Dots. I'm Allison Rose Levy, and we're here every Wednesday at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. I'm a longstanding journalist of health, food, and the environment, reporting on Alternet, the Huffington Post, Truthout, Truthdig, and other venues, as well as hosting Connect the Dots here for the last 7 years. Each week on the show, we connect the dots between your personal well-being and the well-being of our food, water, air, and earth, our communities, our society, and the ecological balance and stability of our habitat, planet Earth. And each week on the show, I talk with different thought leaders, scientists, advocates, authors, filmmakers, and more about all of the different facets of our world that collectively co-create and support our lives and the well-being that we enjoy. On today's show, I'm really thrilled to have with me a very distinguished guest. He is a leading pioneer of the food and farming movement as we know it today, and has been originating, teaching, disseminating, and contemplating all of what we need for healthy food, healthy farms, and a healthy habitat. My guest today is Frederick Kirschenmann. He is a longtime national and international leader in sustainable agriculture, and he shares an appointment as Distinguished Fellow for the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture, as well as president of the Stone Barn Center for Food and Agriculture in Pocantico Hills, New York, and while also managing his family's 1,800-acre certified organic farm in South Central North Dakota. So, you know, he is, he speaks as a farmer and a manager of systems, not, you know, merely from academic interests, but from, you know, kind of hands in the dirt, cultivation and development and the whole movement that we know of that's been happening with the return to healthy foods, to local farming, you know, really began with him and a few other thought leaders and pioneers. Fred is also a professor in the ISU Department of Religion and Philosophy and holds a doctorate in philosophy from the University of Chicago. He's held numerous appointments, including the USDA, the U.S. Department of Agriculture's National Organic Standards Board, and actually that is part of our topic today. So I won't go on from there, although more can be found by Googling him on the Leopold Center for Sustainable Agriculture and the Stone Barn Center website. But we'll just kind of launch into our conversation. I'm so happy to have you with us today on Connect the Dots. Welcome, Fred.
Well, it's entirely my pleasure. I'm looking forward to our conversation.
So, you know, what we're going to be talking about today is a matter coming before the National Organic Standards Board, on which you have served. And, you know, one of the things, I'll just share a short anecdote because, you know, we have a long ways to go, and I think more and more people are becoming aware and awakened and educated. But, you know, when Michael Pollan, who is a childhood friend of my family, actually, first wrote, you know where your food comes from, I think that was, you know, kind of the signature mantra for a whole development of awareness about the reality that the quality of our food and our own health reliance on food, you know, which depends on that quality, really, you know, does not originate in the farmer's market, does not originate in the supermarket, does not originate in the restaurant, but really comes from the land. And what comes to us as food today has a lot to do with getting the right balance between the right policies that support a healthy food supply and policies that support an unhealthy food supply. And, you know, if that sounds a little dualistic, I think there's truth in that in an age where, you know, we have widespread conventional food sources and food agriculture sources that involve, you know, harsh use of the land, heavy pesticide use, lower nutrient levels, and all of that confers to the people who are eating it and feeding it to their families. So, you know, This is the Health Network, Progressive Radio Network, originally founded by Gary Null, a longtime health journalist in New York. And so we speak to people who are health aware and food aware, and we also need to be food policy aware, because we can't just, you know, depend on organic, you know, what we fought long and hard for, the organic standards label remaining organic, unless we assure that it does, and especially in a time like the present. So, Fred, could you acquaint our listeners with, you know, what is going on right now, you know, what is upcoming at the National Organic Standards Board that you and other leaders in organic agriculture regard as a real hazard for organic food, the future of organic food?
Yes, well, it's interesting that you mentioned Michael Pollan, because when you mentioned his name, I recalled in my mind an article that he wrote, if I remember correctly, I think it was in the New York Times Magazine several years ago. And in the middle of that article, he made a statement. He said, "Suppose we were thinking of food as less of a thing and more of a relationship." And I've always thought that was, of all of his keen insights, one that we really need to pay attention, especially now. And what he meant by food as a relationship is not just relationship to among people, but relationships to nature. And the reason that that's so important from my point of view, because this debate that we're having about organic and its relationship to soil versus organic as simply an input system, as it is in hydroponics, we need to think about that, not just in terms of you know, what that means for our food today, but especially what it means, you know, I think we need to start thinking ahead at least 20 or 30 years from now. And the thing that we have to come to terms with is that our relationship to soil is going to increasingly become, not just for organic, but for our whole food system, increasingly become critical, because all of the inputs that we have been using in this input-intensive food system that we've had now for at least a century, those inputs are almost all non-renewable. And therefore, they're going to be there in the process of becoming depleted. It's not just fossil fuels, but it's rock phosphate. It's fossil water. You know, we're using up all of our fresh water resources. 70% of our fresh water resources are being used just for agriculture irrigation. And the reason we need so much water is because we haven't paid attention to the biological health of the soil, so it would absorb more rainfall and have more moisture in the soil, so we have to use more irrigation water. So all of these resources will become depleted, and as they are, the costs will and already are going up. And so we are going to have to really transition now from an input-intensive food system to a term which I like that's being used increasingly now, is a regenerative food system. In other words, everything that we use to produce our food has to get renewed in the process of using it. And the foundation of all of that is the soil. You know, we still sometimes in our culture today think of soil simply as dirt. Even our soil scientists as recently as 10 years ago often referred to soil as simply a material to hold a plant in place. But soil, in fact, is a living community. And David Montgomery has been writing about that extensively now, just in the last few years. And he and his wife, Ann Bickla, published a book late in 2015 called The Hidden Half of Nature. And what they mean by the hidden half of nature are the microbes in the soil. And they point out that there are more microbes in a tablespoonful of soil than there are humans on the planet. In other words, 7 billion microbes in a tablespoonful of soil. And it's those microbes that we have to feed now in order to make the soil regenerative, so that while the soil produces our food, it also becomes renewed in the process of using them. And for me, that's the key issue. This isn't this debate about organic allowing hydroponic, which is simply an input system. This isn't just a debate about the details today. This is really thinking about the future. This is a silly way to go because soil has to become the foundation, and especially the regeneration of soil has to become the foundation of all of our food system. And for organic to go in a different direction than that now would be a huge mistake for it.
So thank you. That's a terrific orientation to the current concern, which is that the board upcoming in October is currently slated to be making a consideration whether, you know, to proceed and include hydroponic, in other words, water-grown rather than soil-grown foods, acceptable under the organic label. And in the past, when this has come before that board, it was voted vehemently, really voted down. I think there was only one person that was in favor of it, and, you know, for the reasons that you're stating. And yet, nevertheless, this form of food growing, or whatever you want to call it, cultivation, has persisted, has continued. You know, Driscoll is a huge producer of berries, and, you know, their hydroponic lettuces. You know, these are all grown in water. And when, you know, you speak of inputs, you know, with little droppers of other kind of nutrients plugged in, so that instead of accessing and, you know, kind of the plant taking the nutrients from the soil, and then when parts of the plant that are, you know, that are not eaten or harvested, you know, decay and fall back into the soil, that is what, you know, that's regenerative. That's where the soil becomes renewed. Instead, this input orientation, which you mention, is like, you know, it's like we're chemists in a lab and we measure out and take a few droplets of this and a few droplets of that to supply the food that's grown hydroponically with water, with nutrients that, you know, it isn't receiving from the earth and it's not generating itself. And so this is a kind of, this is, you know, has been happening, and I'm sure many people, myself included, I wasn't aware of this. You know, I belong to the Park Slope Food Co-op. I'm co-coordinating editor of their small in-house newspaper to our population there. And I myself, I'm sure I was buying, you know, hydroponically grown berries and lettuces without the awareness. In fact, I recently, just as I was kind of being educated about this by you and by Dave Chapman and Lisa Stocky, who were on an earlier broadcast discussing this, I realized that a particular brand of lettuce that I'd gotten just kind of, and had been eating, but always felt reluctant to finish the bag because, you know, I had trouble finishing the bag of salad greens because it was like sort of, I don't know, it was wan.
Yeah.
It was wan.
Yeah.
It didn't have that vibrancy that,
yeah,
you know, draws us, and that we, you know, if we're accustomed to it, we can feel coming from freshly grown food. And I had no idea that it was grown hydroponically. I'm sure many people out there are buying these foods like I have been, not knowing, you know. But I actually can feel a difference. And, you know, yeah, it might be a buck or two cheaper or something, but there is a big difference. And, you know, what I love also in what you said is that it kind of, you know, the show is called Connect the Dots, and we try to connect the dots because just like these food inputs, which are like, you know, we'll have a few droppers full of nutrients, some of which are becoming depleted, as you describe, you know, we'll just put that into the water for these plants. You know, we tend to think as if everything is, you know, we're little lab rat biochemists, and that's how the world operates. If we can only measure out the right dose of something, you know, that's all we need to know, and yay, we have a product. Where, you know, we're actually living in a larger, interconnected biological system, and, you know, where all of these adjustments have ramifications, and we are not aware of what many of those are. We're not tuned in to the fact that it's even happening on any kind of, you know, except if we go out in nature and kind of, you know, but it's really, you know, your work and the work of farmers and others to really understand how the whole system works. And so both on it, you know, and this is, you know, making hydroponics organic is basically a system, a systemic intervention that has repercussions that we can't see when we are buying that bag of lettuce. But every time we have this extractive approach to nature, we're going to take a few things from it and do this and that with it and make a profit, you know, we're kind of forgetting what the and maybe completely ignorant of, because no one else is talking about except for people like you and food movement colleagues. You know, very few people are talking about the ramifications of our choices and how they will affect us and our children. So, I mean, that's what I'm just kind of contextualizing a little bit what you're speaking about. You know, what have you learned, and you know, as someone who has been looking at food from a systemic, ecological perspective, like what do we need to look for and understand about our food and its part in our overall ecological world that we live in, and it's at risk.
Yeah, well, there's a couple of things, especially to me, that are important. First of all, it'd be my experience as a farmer on my own farm. You know, Sir Albert Howard, I think, was the first thinker, you know, back in the 1940s. He published his first book, An Agriculture Testament, in 1940. And he took issue with this input-intensive kind of an approach. In fact, he referred to it as the NPK mentality, NPK being nitrogen, phosphorus, and potash, that all you needed to do was to put these three inputs in, and then you didn't have to worry about the laborious process of managing your soils. And he said that was a form of banditry, because it was going to steal healthy soil from future generations. And so he came up with the concept of the law of return, that we need to manage our soil so that we return, you know, what we use, so that, and again, it's that life in the soil which then takes those wastes that we return to the soil, whether it's compost or whatever else that we return. And that's what feeds those microbes in the soil. So that's a key part of it in terms of the future. But the other kind of relationship that's important here, which is just beginning to emerge now, and that is the health connections of the food that we eat. And you know, fortunately, there are now a few health professionals who are beginning to recognize, and again, David Montgomery and Ann Bickla make this connection between soil health and human health in their book, The Hidden Half of Nature, because they point out that when you eat food from soil that is fed by these healthy microbes in the soil, then that food feeds the good microbes in your gut, which contributes to your health. Now, you know, some of my colleagues say, but a lot more research needs to be done, granted, but there is some anecdotal evidence that that, in fact, is true. But there are now some healthcare professionals, among them Daphne Miller, who is a healthcare professional in California, teaches family medicine at the University of California, and also operates a clinic of her own. And she is now discovering, as a healthcare professional, that when she puts her patients on food, whole food that's grown on healthy soil, then they become healthy. And Maya Stratit Klein, who runs a children's clinic in the Bronx in New York, and she's written a book called The Dirt Cure. And she goes into great detail, again, of her own experience. And usually for her, parents who have children who become ill because of diet-related diseases, which are exploding, and then they take their children to their local clinic, and they usually put them on some kind of pharmaceutical, which keeps the children from getting worse, but it doesn't heal them. And they discover Mayor Strateet Klein's clinic, and so they take their children to her clinic, and she puts them on whole food from healthy soil, and in a matter of weeks, they begin to become healed and become whole again. We still have a long way to go to really develop this culture, because one of the other things, again, we have to come to terms with here is that our healthcare costs are exploding. We're now spending 18% of GDP on healthcare. And professionals who are following this indicate that if, and this rate has continually gone up since the 1960s. And then I think if I remember right, in 1960, we were spending about 3% of GDP on healthcare, and now we're at 18%. And they're saying if we continue this trend, then by the year 2050, it'll be 25% of GDP, and the economy can't function under those terms. So we have to come to terms with this, and this is why, again, I think that I'm trying to do everything I can, and a growing number of my colleagues are as well, to point out how important it is now, not only for our economic future, but also for our health future, to realize the important role that soil plays, the soil when it's managed appropriately, in terms of feeding those good guys in the soil. That's I think going to be critical for our future.
Yeah, it's really interesting connecting the soil and the the microbiome, which is the inner microbes in throughout our digestive tract and our gut, that are really the foundation of both our assimilation of nutrients and our excretion of, other matter, as well as our immune system, our ability to be healthy, and all of that. And, we've had Maya Strateet Klein on the show, and her, the Dirt Cure is terrific, and her work is fabulous, and people can Google, connect the dots and the Dirt Cure and, listen to that show. But, the thing that happens, though, is that, again, when we isolate a specific microbe and we, the pharmaceuticals will typically isolate a microbe and sort of try to kill it off as an unhealthy microbe. And then what the, those who study the microbiome, there's a terrific professor out of Stanford who's been really leading the charge on that. And he's been on the show too. His name is eluding me at the moment. But what happens is when we target one bug and we make it the enemy, or we make anything the other, that's the other, I'm going to kill it and get rid of it and my problem will go away. That whole mode of thinking is actually off, because we then create different problems. We've wiped out the healthy ones, and the toxic microbes then, and yeasts and everything come bouncing back in greater force.
Exactly.
And that's how people develop tremendous, digestive, which are problems, which are rampant in this country, and immune system problems. Autoimmunity and allergies and all of that is rampant as well. but it all comes from this mode of thought that, if there's something I don't like, I should just try to get rid of it. Rather than bringing in, and the solution, which you so eloquently described, is let's bring in the healthy microbes, more healthy microbes coming in to our guts, to our soils, to our vision for what we want in our democracy and for this planet, more healthy people and things and microbes joining in, working together. It's really a synergistic solution. It's not this little, here in the lab, I isolated this drop, and now I either feed it to this plant or I come up with something that kills that drop, forgetting that we're all in an interconnected system. We have the idea that the individual microbe or the individual person survives alone, or, if I eat this individual food, then I'll be immune to what's going on now or in the future. But in fact, it's really it's a community job on all levels, and you know, both on a local level and on a national level and on a global level, it's a community job for the good stuff, the good bugs, the good folks to work together. And so, you know, we don't want to have our food extracted from that process.
Right. Yeah, yeah, and this is again where you know we've had these. Stalwarts of wisdom in the past who have understood, you know, aspects of everything that you've mentioned. And, you know, one of my heroes, obviously, is Aldo Leopold. And Aldo Leopold, in one of his essays, made this observation. He said that we humans are not the conquerors of what he called the land community. And what he meant by land community was this entire biological ecology, you know, everything from the microbes to, you know, to mammals. He said, we are not the conquerors of the land community. We're simply plain members and citizens. and that, I think, again, is a cultural transformation which needs to happen because we've come out of this culture going back to, well, you can, the date which I like to figure is 1841 when you know some of our early thinkers were saying that we had to become the masters and possessors of nature, that nature was simply this collection of objects and we had to manipulate it and master it, become the masters and possessors. And in point of fact, we're simply plain members and citizens, so we need to learn how we become a part of nature and use nature in a way that recognizes the contribution that it can make to our own health so long as we become a part of it in a way that allows the, you know, again, as you mentioned, you know, the good microbes, you know, if we think we can control things and all we got to do is use the antimicrobial stuff to get rid of the bad microbes and then we, in the process, kill the good microbes so that they can't do their job of balancing the microbial community so that it actually is a part of a benefit to us. So these are deep cultural issues that I think is going to take some time. One of the things that encourages me, and I don't want to be overly romantic about the millennial generation, but in my career now, I have the opportunity to work with so many of them, especially at the Stone Barns. I don't think anybody has ever done a real survey to find out what the percentage of the millennials are that have already transitioned to this other culture. But there's a significant number of them, and they're not interested in controlling the world. They're interested in how can they be a part of it in a way, you know, that maintains the health of the whole. And so that's very encouraging, but it's a major cultural transformation that we have to go through. And this is, you know, gets us back to the debate between organic and hydroponic. I mean, to me, I'm not saying that hydroponics are bad, but they should do their own brand, you know, so that, you know, people can differentiate that from. And within organic, we also have to, because not all of organic is currently, you know, following Sir Albert Howard's view of organic as, you know, in terms of the law of return. Sometimes, I mean, all you need to do to get certified organic is to use natural inputs instead of synthetic inputs, or at least those that are in the approved list. But the people, at least that I know, that are arguing so strenuously now to maintain the soil as a critical part of organic, recognize that, you know, this wisdom from the past, and that it is the sustainability of the future of organic. But I think that, you know, I guess what I'm trying to say is I'm hopeful that we can begin to make this cultural transformation, but we still have a long way to go.
Mm-hmm. Yes. that's right. I mean, I too am very, very heartened by the millennials, and you know, have the opportunity to support their efforts, really, and you know, the entire kind of under 40 generation that really, you know, sees themselves as stewards of their own future, and you know, where for you know, prescient pioneers and you know, from all time that can, you know, that have been kind of creating understandings that really are in line with the path forward, you know, over the past century and more, you know, that's fantastic. And, you know, and now it is also their time. And so all that we can do
right.
to support them,
absolutely.
You know, is really, I agree. And it's also hopeful because a lot of people look at sort of the large cogs of the machinery of our world, and, you know, they become overwhelmed by, you know, the thought of, you know, how do we intervene? And, you know, we're powerless, there's nothing we can do. But actually, you know, in the end, the interconnecting systems, biological systems of the Earth are more powerful than anything that, you know, we are devising. And so, you know, the question is, do we want to be aligned with what is supporting life, and is, you know, stronger, you know, basically, you know, more vibrant and powerful and sophisticated and subtle and complex, and, you know, what these technologies that we've devised. And so, you know, how do we support those movements forward? And I think participating, you know, and staying current with, you know, what's happening at the Organic Standards Board. I mean, in many cases, you know, some we lose and some we win, but this is an opportunity for citizen participation, just, you know, as you're
right.
talking about how we are, you know, all citizens of the Earth, and this is yet another opportunity for a very constructive participation in, you know, giving back to the Earth through keeping organic soil-based and deterring the industry pressures at the upcoming Organic Standard Board meeting, you know, that would kind of have it otherwise. And it doesn't mean, again, we have to sacrifice hydroponics, that can still have them, but just not confusing that issue. Are there economic concerns, you know, if the hydroponics became organically certified, you know, would this constitute an undermining of regenerative and soil-based agriculture in some kind of, you know, economic or operational sense?
Sure, yeah, and I, you know, and my own perspective on this is that the reason we're even having this debate is entirely based on market advantage. You know, the only reason I think that hydroponics wants to have the organic label is because it gives them it makes their product more attractive in the marketplace because, as we all know, the organic market has been growing really rapidly. So they want to hitch on to that market advantage. And from a short-term perspective, I understand that. But again, in the longer-term perspective, and I think that any of us who are, especially if we have grandchildren, you know, we need to start thinking about, you know, what kind of world are our grandchildren going to be living in, you know, 30, 40, 50 years from now. And of course, we could have a long conversation about that. But again, this recognizing the important role that soil will play in their lives in terms of the food that they eat, is going to be critical, and that then will have the reverse market impact. And so I think that you know, we need to make the issue of the importance of whole food from healthy soil, you know, a part of our marketing strategy, a part of our eating habits, so that we will be healthier in the future ourselves. And then for those who want to have the short-term market return, you know, they can do that as long as it works for them, and then eventually they're going to have to, like everyone else, become a part of the soil food health phenomenon, because that's where the future is headed.
Mm-hmm. So, in fact, if we, and we have to also assure that the future, you know, it's economically feasible for farmers to farm and, you know, to get the return that comes from, you know, growing food in a healthy and regenerative way rather than favoring, you know, this this other method now, which is actually just a short-term gain method that will not really help. You know, when we mean sustainable, it's just kind of, you know, the word is used so often, it can sometimes seem like a buzzword to people, but if we unpack it, it means, you know, is this going to be what is feeding the future going forward? Is that going to, you know, work that way? And if it isn't, then it yet, you know, even though those berries may taste good today and I'm happy I can have them and put them in my bowl, you know, so that's like, again, a short-term benefit. But in the long range, if we allow the economic structures for the ongoing and continuous and future building soil-based form of organic to be undermined, then again we're pushing the price tag, you know, back down to the next and future generations, and we really can't do that. And that's also, I think, I mean, do the young people with whom you're interacting at Stone Barns, you know, what do you hear from them? Like, what they're aware of this. I'm sort of always amazed at the wisdom of this generation, that at their ability to grasp what eludes, you know, some of the elders. You know, what is their perspective on farming? What is drawing them? What is you know, what do they see as the gift to them coming from soil-based? Sustainable growing.
Well, you raise a really interesting point, and that is, you know, what motivates and drives farmers in, you know, in a larger society now. And, even one of our secretaries of agriculture, 25 years ago, said farmers had to get bigger, get out, and they had to produce, they had to farm fence row to fence row and produce as much as possible. And so it's all about yield and producing quantity, and the way you do that is you specialize. So most farmers now only raise one or two crops or one kind of animal, and they specialize in that and, you know, grow it as quickly as possible and produce as much as possible. But increasingly also now, even for farmers, you know, if it weren't for public subsidies, most farmers couldn't do what they're doing now. And some farmers are beginning to recognize this. And again, David Montgomery has come out with another new book, which just came out in April this year, called Growing a Revolution, Bringing Health Back to Soil. And he writes this book based on, I think it's 8 farmers that he visited, spent you know, about 3 weeks on each of these farms. And these are farmers, these are not organic farmers, which is interesting. These are farmers who have recognized that simply producing as much as possible, you know, was just not working for them economically. And so they started to change their system, and they basically are doing 3 things that are different now. They reduce their tillage, they add cover crops, and cover crops add, again, contributes to that health of soil when you include that, because you're feeding the microbes with those cover crops, and they increase their diversity so that they have, again, the different kinds of entities, biological factors on the farm. In some cases, it's crop and livestock integration. In some cases, it's simply, instead of just growing corn and soybeans, they raise 5 or 6 or 7 different kinds of crops in rotation, which, of course, again, activates and feeds the microbes. And here's the interesting thing. Each of these farmers now are no longer interested in getting bigger. They're interested in continuing to increase the biological dynamics of their system, because That's the thing that now makes them economically successful. Each of these farmers now are discovering they've dramatically reduced their input costs and therefore their net profits, and therefore that's why they're not interested in getting bigger anymore. And, you know, a good example of this is Gabe Brown, who's a farmer in North Dakota. And his farm is right on the west side of the Missouri River, which is in that shortgrass prairie ecology, which is not the highest, the best kind of soil. But he's been farming this way now for, I think, 12 years. And in North Dakota, you can't raise a cover crop in the same year that you raise, that you raise a cash crop because the growing season is too short. So he uses the cover crop in a rotation. And then he raises beef animals, among other things. His son also now raises all kinds of other, chickens, et cetera. So he uses the cover crop as a crop, but then uses that for grazing his livestock. So when the cover crop reaches its maturity, he puts his beef animals in there in a small spot with an electric fence, and then they graze it all down so they terminate it, and then he can no-till the next crop in. But here's the important thing. A typical farmer in Iowa now who is doing a typical corn-soybean kind of rotation and has to use all of those inputs, it's now costing them about $4 a bushel just in input cost to raise corn. Gabe Brown is now raising corn for $1.41 a bushel in input costs.
Wow.
And his soil has become so vibrant now that instead of his soil only absorbing a half inch of rainwater an hour, which is pretty standard for our industrial kind of farming operations now, half inch and then it starts to run off, his soil is now absorbing 8 inches of rainwater an hour.
Wow.
So again, when you have, we have to also talk about the impact of climate change here and the more drought periods, more flooding periods. So when you have the heavy rains, his soil absorbs the moisture into the soil. And then you have the drought period, the soil has moisture in it to continue to sustain the crops during those periods of time. So I mention all of this because, you know, I'm always looking for a little of the good news, and especially for farmers, I think every farmer who is finding himself or herself in a situation where this highly specialized cropping system with all of the intensive inputs that they need is no longer working for them economically, they should read David Montgomery's Growing a Revolution book, and I think it would provide them with some insights about the future of agriculture that's really, again, based on, the healthy soil concept.
Well, I think it's also extremely valuable for, ordinary citizens, like me and my listeners to know this, because this actually, we talk about regenerative, that's a multi-syllable word. And so what does that actually mean? Or when we talk about sustainable, what are we actually talking about? Your example, shows what is that actually happening? If you can raise food for less money, if it's holding the earth is holding the water, so that we're keeping water from evaporating, even in a dry region, and therefore with, with the different effects of climate change coming, then you've got one farm, many farms, many regions, hopefully, that deploy that system. That means that, we both slow climate change and we provide food. Those are the two, long-range effects of what you're talking about. And, as we've seen in many ways, we are, because of the economic system, we're looking very short-sightedly at the immediate return without looking at the long-term impact. And we're really in a time where, because of climate change and because of, proceeding in that short-term thinking in ways that are very detrimental to climate, we really have to shift focus and move in another direction. And I think you're move in the direction you're describing, because this really shows why, how that would work, and what's behind these terms, you know, so city folk and people who are not as close to, you know, the life cycles on a farm, or, you know, who, or suburbanites maybe, you know, who grow some vegetables, you know, can really understand, you know, the importance of this to the future. I mean, instead of just wringing out every last buck for today, it's like creating a system that builds wealth.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, through the land, rather than trying to take everything from the land and, you know, whatever happens next, you know, après moi, le déluge. I think that's what Antoinette said, and, you know, unfortunately, we don't want that to be the prophetic statement for our time. Yeah, that's really very, thank you for that. I think it's really important and also really fascinating. So, and again, it helps farmers give hearts, you know, keep heart and you know, more people to, you know, if we want this kind of food, if organic food is growing leaps and bounds because people, you know, we want it. Consumers want it. People want it. Mothers want it. Fathers want it to feed their children. You know, if that's what we want, then we want to create the best conditions for producing it and for more people to have it. You know, my long-term dream has always been that, you know, it gets to a point where it's accessible, everyone can access it. It's not just for people in certain areas or people who can afford it, but, you know, it's like how can we shift our social priorities so that everyone gets to, you know, enjoy healthy food and, you know, receive the gifts and the health support that comes from that kind of food. So, I, you know, that's part of my dream for the future. You know, and I think it's fine to pioneer things, you know, as things begin among, you know, a certain population that kind of serves as the lab and has the affluence to do so, you know, to kind of establish this is a good thing. But then when we're at the phase where that's been established and that's why it's popular, then instead of moving away from supporting that on a systemic level, we need to, you know, all the people who care about this already and who are wanting to buy it need to really be educated and understand this is the moment to step up and push for or taking the right fork in the road, you know, to you know, support and perpetuate it and get, you know, and welcome more people to it and stuff. I think part of one of the argument for hydroponics, because we've been discussing the upcoming vote on the National Organic Standard Board about whether water-grown food, you know, kind of grown in with healthier inputs but in an industrial fashion removed from the soil, should, you know, receive the organic label. And we're hearing today with my guest Fred Kirschenman all the reasons why it should not. but, you know, I guess, you know, people need to really understand what's at stake here. And, I mean, how engaged do you feel that the, you know, people who enjoy healthy food, how engaged are, you know, are we? How engaged is that group? How much have, how well have we done the job of understanding and gathering people to take a stand for making the right turn in the road?
Yeah, well, it's part of a cultural revolution, and as we know from our long history as humans, you know, these revolutions always take some time, and this one will as well. But I do think one of the things that makes me hopeful is there is certainly an increasing number, and our even major food companies like General Mills, et cetera, are beginning to realize that their customers now want food from healthy soil, that they want to know where the food came from. They want to know who produced it. They want that information. And so they're beginning to redesign their marketing systems to begin the process to accommodate this new market. So I think that And again, depending on how rapidly the millennial generation begins to dominate our culture, this is where the future is going.
I mean, what do you say to the, you know, kind of playing devil's advocate to the counter argument that by growing hydroponically, more people can, you know, access healthier food today, right now. More people could be reached, could, yeah, the cost could be lower at all, you know, all of that. I mean, what do you, yeah, say to that?
Yeah, absolutely. And I'm not demonizing hydroponics at all. I simply don't want the public to assume that hydroponics is the same as organic and that, you know, that's because it's not. You know, the difference here is an intensive input system versus a system that is regenerative, grounded in soil. And so that's why it should not be in the same marketing ballpark. These should be two different markets. And I'm all for hydroponic in the short term. I think they're going to be successful, and they should do that, and they have their own brand. Just don't confuse the public that it's the same as organic and the same as a soil-based food system. And in the longer term, too, I think we're going to, and this, of course, we need more research around this, I think we're going to begin to see that hydroponic, which is not grounded in the healthy soil, is not going to have the same health benefits that vegetables grown in healthy soil are going to have. And again, Maestro T. Klein and Daphne Miller are, early indicators in our healthcare system that there is that distinction.
Mm-hmm. It's kind of like what the hydroponics do is they remove some of the toxins, which organics are also designed to keep out. So, in other words, you don't have the heavy pesticide use, sure, you know, and herbicides and all of that. You know, you don't, all of that goes away. So you know those toxins are removed, and in that sense, they are cleaner and healthier to consume than, you know, conventional agriculture, which is, you know, overladen with these pesticides as well as, you know, glyphosate and genetically modified organisms, things that we're kind of conducting an experiment about because they haven't been in use that long term. So all of that is really good. I mean, studies have shown, you know, the range of health impacts from pesticide use. But then there's the other side of the coin, which is the higher nutrients. And people like Charles Benbrook and others have, you know, researched the differences. And then this whole level, you know, between specific nutrients, vitamins and minerals that are, you know, that we receive from food. And, you know, so that is, obviously, as well as what we were discussing earlier, the microbe cycle, that comes from regeneratively grown food, and so that's a whole other order of benefits. So, and that is a significant difference. So, you know,
exactly,
just on the purely what's good for me human health level. But so that's why all of these three, you know, why all of these should be clear and distinct in our understanding.
Exactly.
People can make the choices, you know, accordingly. I mean, there's a lot about all of these toxic exposures that we simply, you know, are beginning to learn, beginning to know about. We could know a lot more about how they interact, you know, the various toxins to which we're exposed. So, you know, removing toxins is always a good thing. You know, we don't really know. Like, you know, the assumption is always it's just a little bit, you know. But a little bit and a little bit and a little bit of this and a little bit of that and a little bit of the other over
exactly,
a lifetime, you know, gets stored in our tissues and interact with our function in ways that really we don't completely understand, because in the same way that we just want to, you know, kill the bug by using a pesticide and kill the germ by using an antibiotic, you know, we you know, we don't think about the systemic effects of, you know, on us when we do that kind of killing.
Right.
Any comment that you have on toxins in agriculture and conventional agriculture?
Yeah, well, again, you know, I think one of the things that we have to come to terms with is that science is always a process. You know, it's not a collection of incontrovertible facts. I mean, there are some, but mostly it's a process. And you know, the scientific community is continuing to explore some of these things. But, you know, there's increasing evidence now that if you really want to eat the food that is going to have the best health consequences for you, then it's food that's grown, first of all, without all of the health problems connected with, you know, pesticides, et cetera. And I know that companies that produce these pesticides, they keep wanting to justify what they're doing. And, you know, glyphosate is a good example. You know, the scientific community still is, you know, has kind of mixed ideas about that or mixed conclusions about it. But, you know, this is where the precautionary principle comes in. I mean, if you're an eater and you want to choose the best food for yourself, then why would you want to select food that has been grown with these pesticides when the evidence is increasingly emerging that this has health consequences? And even though we can't prove all of it to the full extent yet, science is a process, and eventually it will do that. But you make a choice and use a precaution and eat the foods that have not been grown with the pesticides. And then you take the next step and eat food that has been whole food that has been produced on healthy soil to see what impact that has, you know, on your own health. And I think that, you know, again, that's simply a rational way to go. And so this, again, gets us back to the differentiation. I mean, certainly eating vegetables that are grown hydroponically is preferable from this precautionary perspective than eating vegetables that have been grown with a lot of pesticides. But there's a potentially additional benefit from eating vegetables that have been grown without pesticides that are grown on healthy soil, which is the way organic food you know, can be grown and in many instances is grown and needs to be grown. And that's the food of the future.
Mm-hmm. And that food is both good for us today and it's also good for the climate, the future food supply, and all the rest going forward. Thank you so much for being with me and our listeners today on Connect the Dots, Fred Kirschenman. And thank you for your, you know, outstanding work in this entire arena and for explaining to us, you know, what is what we need to stand with and protect in terms of healthy food and the healthy food supply. It's been a, you know, a real pleasure and honor having you on the show.
It's my pleasure as well. Thank you.
And thank you, listeners, for being with us on today's edition of Connect the Dots. Please check back to our archives for previous programs with Dave Chapman and Maya Chitri Klein, whom we mentioned on the show. And if you've enjoyed this show, please share it with others at connectthedots.podbean.com so that more can learn and understand and benefit from this wonderful conversation with Fred Kirschenman. I'm Allison Rose Levy. Join us next week at 10 a.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Be well, chin up, and keep marching forward with all our relations.